Okay, I wanted to start by saying thank you to everyone for coming and also giving my thanks to people who I know would love to have been here and can't. I'm not going to give lots of thanks because it would take ages and we'd never get through to the wine. As Michael has just said, I came to Sussex as an undergraduate and I've stayed here, and occasionally I get asked as if, you know, have you stayed here, as if I've done that by some kind of accident. But I have to say I've stayed here as a choice for this long, and I continue to want to be here. It's a fascinating place to work and a wonderful place to do the kind of work that I want to do. Now, I'm not going to be talking about children this evening, although I have got to say thank you to a child in the audience, as my daughter Ella, who has put up with me writing this lecture for what feels to her like an eternity. So I will say thank you to her and embarrass her for that. But from that, I just want to go straight into the topic tonight, which is called The Arts of Looking. And it's a question I've been interested in for quite a long time and is coming together in various ways. Tonight it's a way really of kind of opening up a field of inquiry with which I'm engaged and which I hope will be of interest to people here. So the basic question is there an art to looking? Is there a technique or a practice or an effort towards seeing? And I want to start with a quote from a recent novel. "It takes work, pious effort, to see what you are looking at," writes Don DeLillo towards the beginning of Point of Meagre, his most recent novel, which was published in February 2010. "It takes close attention to see what is happening in front of you." Now, it's a fascinating claim that to look is not or not necessarily to see, and a fascinating scene. A man, barely visible, we are told, in the very first line of the book, is standing against the wall of a cold and dark gallery. There are no seats, there's very little light, there's just a faint shimmer coming from a screen about 10 by 14 feet set in the middle of a room. A film is running without dialogue, without music. In fact, there's no soundtrack at all. The man is watching the screen, and DeLillo is very specific about this. And then a quote, "The man at the wall watched the screen," unquote. And what he is watching is Anthony Perkins, quote, "reaching for a car door using the right hand," unquote. Now, Point of Meagre begins and indeed ends with a man watching Douglas Gordon's 24-hour Psycho. As its title suggests, Gordon's large-scale video projection, which was first screened at Tramway in Glasgow and at the Kunstwerke Institute for Contemporary Art in Berlin in 1993. As the title suggests, this work transforms Alfred Hitchcock's classic film, released in 1960, into a work that runs for 24 hours. Now, it's a work without sound, a work that you can walk around, as you can see from the way these screens are set up. You can view from either side of a freestanding screen. Now, sometimes, though not on the occasion described in Point of Meagre, 24-hour Psycho is projected on a split screen like this one, slowed and shown running forward and in reverse side by side. And that installation is known as 24-hour Psycho Back and Forth and To and Fro. Now, that was the version screened as part of the Guggenheim Museum's 24-hour event on the concept of time in January 2009. So I've got another couple of images of what this looks like. Now, it was towards the end of the 1920s, and with the advent of talking pictures, that the projection of 35mm film at the rate of 24 frames per second became the industry standard on which, decades later, 24-hour Psycho is propped. "Photography is truth, and cinema is truth 24 times a second," Jean-Luc Godard's well-known aphorism, announces the technical achievement of early cinema, this transition from still to moving photographs, at the same time as it draws attention to an ongoing investment in film as site of truth and knowledge, a new standard for representing the world. The photograph, one of our most powerful modes of seeing and knowing, is, so the argument runs, at once contained and surpassed by the illusion of movement on screen. Movement is life, as the poet and early film critic Robert Herring put the point enthusiastically in 1928, and cinema is the only art that can preserve this quality in its expression. Now, to project Psycho at roughly 2 frames per second, which is what Gordon does, to extend the time of Hitchcock's film across a day and a night and to eliminate its sound is basically to intervene in the audiovisual field that is or has been cinema. So it may be worth recalling one of Gordon's more provocative claims that cinema is dead. Using a commercially available video of Hitchcock's Psycho and a VCR with adjustable speed setting, Gordon brings the media of cinema and of video into a relationship that is at once remarkable and everyday, or at least it was everyday in 1993. Now we're far more likely to watch Psycho on DVD or download. Now this is, on one level, a technological encounter. In 24-hour Psycho, and 2 years before its centenary in 1995, cinema encounters the medium that, combined with the technology of the little big screen, which is Mark Shivers's wonderful phrase for television, combined with the little big screen, had brought the experience of film out of cinema and into the home. Now, it's not until the late 1970s that VCRs penetrated the mass market in the UK, but by the beginning of the 1980s, close to 20% of households owned one. By 1996, the ownership rate was nearly 85%, so it's nearly 85% in the year before the first release of a film on DVD. So this is, in itself, a complex fact in the history of looking and its arts. When the video recorder came along, Gordon has recalled in interview, it just so happened that Glasgow, where I was brought up, had the highest percentage of recorders per capita in Europe because it had the highest unemployment under Thatcher. Or as one study of cultures of unemployment in the Netherlands in the 80s indicated, confirming Gordon's more polemical intuition, the time the jobless used to spend hanging around the street corner is now spent watching television. But the point for Gordon, too, is that his generation, and he's born in 1966, grow up with what he describes as a televisualization of cinema, another form of its death, you might say. The first time that Gordon, like so many of us, watched Psycho was on the television screen. In Gordon's case, it was late one night in his brother's bedroom. Then a student at the Slade School of Fine Art in London, Gordon had gone back to Glasgow for a visit. He was, he says, bored at the Slade. No one else was around, and he couldn't sleep. So this is what he says in an interview. It's one of the origin stories of 24-hour Psycho. They're all basically the same, but there are a few variations on his theme. Being a good Jehovah's Witness boy, I had never seen Psycho because my mum had told me not to watch it, said it was bad. But then I thought, damn it, mum's in bed, so I can watch it, so I did. There's a scene where Janet Leigh takes her bra off, and I thought, I'm going to watch that again in slow motion. Then I thought, well, I'm going to watch the whole thing in slow motion, and it turns out that it was about 24 hours long. Now, this is the second scene of Looking that I want us to hold in mind this evening. It's another fascinating scene, above all, perhaps, of looking as a form of creative play. And I think there's much work to be done on the role of insomnia, sleeplessness, boredom in exploration of new forms of spectatorship, new forms of creative practice. At the origins of 24-hour Psycho is a more or less conventional scene of voyeurism. A woman removes her clothing, a man, unseen, looks at her doing so. In this sense, 24-hour Psycho takes up its place in a long and various history of looking at women, the states of desire, love, terror, violence, humour, and curiosity with which that looking is so often embroiled. Psycho, of course, contains one of the most famous sequences of sexual looking in the history of cinema, and this is perhaps one way to think about the question, why Psycho? Why does Gordon choose to transfer this film into the space of the gallery? Now, I'm hoping this is going to work. I left learning PowerPoint to the afternoon before my professorial lecture. Not a good idea. This is the scene from Psycho. Obviously, that's not slowed down to 2 frames per second. That's Hitchcock's version. But this is the scene that's embedded in Gordon's account of the origins of 24-hour Psycho, and so also, by implication, embedded in Point Omega. There's some complex embeddings going on here. So this is the sequence that arrests Gordon's attention, and you'll have noticed that you do not, in fact, see Janet Leigh remove her clothes. That image remains implied by Norman's look rather than made visible on the screen. At least it remains implied in the commercially available DVD and video cassettes. There is a version, occasionally screened on television, in which the image is censored from the cinematic version of Psycho are shown, so it's possible that what Gordon was looking at was something that had been taped from television. Either way, it's a scene that Gordon tells us prompts him to rewind the film and to watch it slowly. So just give you that, those are the still images from that scene. That is not only to mime the sexual looking that is taking place on screen, the spectator is bound in a formal terms to look from Norman's point of view, but to slow that looking down, to intervene in the time of the film, to make something, to make the woman, but also to make the act of looking itself more visible. Because this sequence is deeply preoccupied by the question of looking, of what can be seen and perhaps what should be seen and how. So to work with Psycho, as various critics have pointed out, is always to work with the history of film censorship. It is also the kind of sequence that generated an entire theoretical discourse on the sexing or gendering of looking. And Psycho is one of the urtexts of both feminist and psychoanalytic film theory. But here also what we are watching is the prelude to the famous shower scene, which lasts just over 2 minutes in Hitchcock's film and over 30 minutes in 24-hour Psycho. And there are stories of people trying to time their entry into the gallery in time to see the shower scene. Lots of stories about that. Now, it is in itself one of the most ambivalent objects of desire in our visual culture. Its montage, a testament to the power of cinema to deliver death in the form of spectacle and shock. In fact, the prologue to Point Omega is embedded in this object. And just to give you the text there, from the cues we are given, the sequence on the screen in the gallery at the beginning of the novel runs from Marion Crane's arrival at the Bates Motel. He watched Anthony Perkins reaching for a car door using the right hand. Through the scene we've just watched, Anthony Perkins at his peephole was watching Janet Leigh undress, to the conclusion of the shower scene. He counted 6 rings, the rings spinning on the curtain rod when she pulls the curtain down with her. The knife, the silence, the spinning rings. It takes close attention to see what is happening in front of you. Well, there is always more to see. In this instance, at the point that it is about to break new ground in its representation of sexuality, murder, and psychosis, Psycho is itself laid open to the difference, the otherness, if you like, within the arts of looking. It is a painting, more precisely a reproduction, framed and inert on the wall, not of the gallery but of the parlour, that by concealing his peephole supports Norman's desires to look, and indeed is used to frustrate our own. Hitchcock is, of course, well known for his sadistic play with his audiences. We cannot really see this painting, not in the course of the film. The camera might take us up close, but it also obscures the image from view. If you try to look at it while the film's moving, you become very aware of the restriction of vision imposed by the camera. You can't see around Norman's head or his shoulders. He's casting a shadow over the painting. And you can't interrupt the relentless purpose of the shot, which is the spectacle of a man's voyeurism and of a woman's sexual vulnerability. Except, of course, that you can, and indeed Gordon does. Slow the film down, and the theme of this painting becomes more apparent. It's a version, unidentified, as many critics have pointed out, but it's a version of Susanna and the Elders, a theme crucial to the representation of the female nude in European art between the 16th and 18th centuries. From the Apocrypha of the Book of Daniel, the story of Susanna is the story of a woman, a wife, falsely accused by two elders who spy on her as she bathes in her garden. Accosting her on her way home, the elders threaten to denounce her as an adulteress if she does not agree to have sex with them. She refuses, is denounced, and sentenced to death. Enter the young prophet Daniel, who stalls proceedings by insisting that the two elders should be separated and questioned separately about what they claim to have seen, often cited as the origins of cross-examination. The community agrees. When questioned, of course, the elders' stories differ in details, particularly they disagree about the name of the tree under which Susanna is supposed to have met her lover, and they are revealed as false accusers. They, rather than Susanna, are put to death. Now, this story of attempted rape, female sexuality, voyeurism, abuse of power, and the authority of the law has been painted by, amongst others, Lorenzo Lotto in 1517, Tintoretto, Rubens in 1607, Anthony van Dyck, 1622, Rembrandt, 1647, I don't think, and this one, which is fascinating, Artemisia, I don't know how to say this, Gentileschi. She was just 17 when she painted this. Now the list could go on. There's a very long list of people who have painted scenes from Susanna and the Elders, but they tend to be scenes where the woman's body can be exposed. This is Picasso's version, my favourite, from 1955, in which the lustful elders have become, with rather telling and possibly vengeful humour, paintings on the wall. Again, Psycho participates in this long history of sexual voyeurism, and by exhibiting this painting, or by exhibiting a version of this painting, it knows that it does. Though not easily seen, Hitchcock's symbolism is blunt. This painting, as film scholar Raymond Berlouer condenses the point, prefigures the effect that Norman is going to produce. Slow the film down, then. You can see what you could not see before. This is film, or more precisely, perhaps the still photograph on which it depends, as a means to expand the field of human vision, to reveal what remains naked, hidden to the naked eye. So a kind of long trajectory of using technology to support human vision. To still the flow of the cinematic image across the screen, to satisfy the desire to extend and to repeat the act of looking, is one of the basic achievements of the VCR, now part of our everyday experience of looking at film and television. But it's an achievement that democratized the means to the analysis of film, previously the preserve of the very few, and it becomes the material basis for studying film at universities, the availability of VCR and commercially available copies of films. As Gordon acknowledges, it was through video that he learned of a previous generation of film scholars, quote, who were looking at film frame by frame in order to exercise the desire for the truth of a movie, unquote. Now, embedded in Gordon's comment is the entire project of film analysis, the shot-by-shot, sequence-by-sequence analysis of the image track of a film. the project made possible when critics take film off the projector and put it onto the editing table. And then far more widely, with the introduction of the VCR. For writing in 1990, Annette Michelson, for example, captured what she called the excitement of that moment for film scholars, its heady delights and thrill of power, to borrow her words. And she kind of wondered, you know, do we get out enough, really? But it was a very exciting moment for people who'd previously been kind of confined to what they could happen to get a print of. Now, this kind of reading in slow motion was already familiar to scholars in the humanities in the form of close reading, textual analysis, and exegesis. It's not surprising, I think, that so many film programs have their origins in departments of English and modern languages. What matters is that film can be stopped and started, rewound and forwarded according to the needs of an analysis. Analysis that, like 24-hour Psycho, changes the normal viewing time of the film. Or as Roland Barthes might say, a reading that changes the object itself. The text that the film scholar works on, the text that Gordon begins to produce in his bedroom, is not the text that he or she sees in cinema, and no one ever pretended that it was. The object is different, the act of looking is different. It is, or can be, methodical to the point of madness, and that was how Bellur, one of the founding fathers of film analysis, described his own monumental and frankly obsessive shot-by-shot analyses of, amongst others, Psycho, North by Northwest, and The Birds. And, I mean, Hitchcock obviously brought this out in people. He really was one of the people who founded film theory in that form. Well, it's a mode of looking that is fascinated, desiring, and open to the pressure exerted by the image, often enough in the form of what anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss describes as the pregnancy of detail. The world of meaning embedded in a single frame, the forms of significance emerging in the movement from one frame to the next. Now, crucially, the film stilled or slowed in this way invites a mode of looking that has become inseparable from the domain of the aesthetic, its claims to the human mind, and that's contemplation. It's a concept with a long and venerable history. As Hannah Arendt puts it at the beginning of her extraordinary book, The Life of the Mind, which was published posthumously in 1977, she died in the course of writing the book, quote, the notion that contemplation is the highest state of the mind is as old as Western philosophy, end quote. She gives a wonderful account of his disciples' stories of Socrates, who would just stop wherever he happened to be, stand motionless for hours, gripped by an idea, utterly absorbed in his thoughts, or so the story goes. And this is the image of contemplation, the mind absorbed in itself and the person, the body, absolutely motionless. Now, as a secularized displacement of devotional or religious forms of contemplation, its association with the work of art in the modern period is persistent. As Carolyn Duttlinger has recently summarized the point, quote, within galleries and museums, works of art continue to be viewed as part of a one-to-one encounter between the auratic image and its contemplative observer, unquote. Now, this is one way, perhaps, to understand the invitation issued by a work like 24-Hour Psycho, an invitation to bring things a bit closer to home, to be still and know. That DeLillo invokes the pious effort, if you remember in that original quote, the first quote I started with, the pious effort demanded by Gordon's art, suggests its claims to that tradition, its complex entanglement with concepts of virtue, responsibility, and respect. There is, I think, much work to be done in understanding the relation between contemplation and responsibility in a secular culture. Much work to be done in thinking the relation between virtue and the technologies of vision at the beginning of the 21st century. And there, that whole run of questions about looking, indifference, the pleasures and pornographies of looking, but also at the other end of the scale, the virtue or otherwise of states of surveillance. I may come back to this a little towards the end, but for now I want to read a brief passage from Walter Benjamin's now classic essay, from 1936, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, an essay very important to these kinds of themes, in which he questions the possibility of contemplating the moving image at all. The painting, he says, invites the spectator to contemplation. Before it, the spectator can abandon himself to his associations, like Socrates. Before the movie frame, he cannot do so. No sooner has his eye grasped a scene than it is already changed. It cannot be arrested. Duhamel, Benjamin is referring to the French author and critic Georges Duhamel, who detests the film and knows nothing of its significance, though something of its structure, notes this circumstance as follows: I can no longer think what I want to think. My thoughts have been replaced by moving images. Now, the debate captured by Benjamin's comments is as old and, for me, as preoccupying as cinema itself. In the movies, writes psychologist Hugo Munsterberg in 1917, we rush from one place to a dozen others, get only glimpses everywhere, never have time to think about the social problem or conflict which the scene suggests. Now, I've picked out that passage. It's typical. It's a very typical description of movies from that period. And if we translate it into thinking about computers or television, so the terms of that debate have not changed that much. Now, one of the basic assumptions at work in such passages, or to push the point, one of the basic assumptions of the century of cinema, the century of moving images, is that there can be a profound correspondence between cinema and mind, between cinema and both what and how the mind thinks. So it's not simply that we're being influenced by what we see, but that how we are seeing it is actually in some way changing the structure of the mind. It's a big, big claim, and I think it's probably more true than one might want to think. The photoplay, as Munsterberg was once again one of the first to proclaim in 1916, obeys the laws of the mind rather than those of the outside world. Again, an interesting claim. This phenomenon, cinema, is being praised as the technology which can give you the most naturalistic depiction of the world. But Munsterberg's saying, yes, but before it does that, it obeys the laws of the mind. Or, as the poet and filmmaker H.D. exclaimed in response to seeing Victor Turin's film Turksib in 1929, thought, one wanted to shout aloud, is here for the first time adequately projected. So that is, if you like, the utopic reversal of Duhamel's repudiation. I can no longer think what I want to think. My thoughts have been replaced by moving images. And this utopic and dystopic response to the technologies of moving images as somehow occupying the mind runs right the way through the criticism. So technology, temporality, and thought. In comparisons between cinema and its sister arts, in particular painting, photography, and literature, the terms will come to underwrite the claim that one of our most valuable arts of looking, contemplation, is under threat from the very movement of the image on screen. So another couple of quotes. The images are seized but not contemplated. The film reel draws the eye along. Sustained thought is out of the question if the spectator is not to miss the relentless rush of facts. Now that's Theodore Adorno giving voice to the anxiety that one of the great achievements of the technologies of the moving image, their potential to mine both world and mind, is also the source of their greatest threat, crudely, the distraction, even the destruction of human thought. At least human thought in its contemplative mode, its privileged association with stillness, silence, absorption in the inner world of thought, and crucially with time. Television accelerates experience, insists Michael Haneke, a filmmaker whose oeuvre offers a serious, even compulsive exploration of ties between media and ethics. Television accelerates experience, but one needs time to understand what one sees, which the current media disallows. Now, Douglas Gordon would appear to concur, if not necessarily, to share Haneke's relentlessly dismal view of television. Ours is a culture, Gordon says, that has, quote, sacrificed time in order to gain speed. A sacrifice thoroughly reversed by 24-hour psycho. Gordon's installation has been described, in fact, as one designed to, quote, make time, unquote, make time for time, perhaps by making time by taking it. It takes time, 24 hours, to watch this film or this installation. And we are always aware of time. In particular, in our context, the context of the universities, the time it takes to think. Reflecting on the pace of life in the 20th century, Arendt would link the activity of thinking, but I want to ask, is this quite the same as contemplation? Not only to our wishes or inclinations or our capacities, but to our experience of time. This absence of thinking, she writes, which is so ordinary an experience in our everyday life, where we hardly have the time, let alone the inclination, to stop and think. So stop and think has become a cliche of the language, of the culture. Stop, or at least slow down, because, in Arendt's view, there is a human need to think, a need propped on the time to ask the unanswerable, the homeless or the undisciplined questions. Questions like, what is being? Who is a man? What meaning has life? What is death? Etc. The etc. is Arendt's. I think that she thinks that these questions are subject to historical and social change. It's not simply a contemplation of the eternal, though it might also be that. It's more than likely, she continues, that men, if they were ever to lose the appetite for meaning we call thinking and cease to ask unanswerable questions, would lose not only the ability to produce those thought things that we call works of art, but also the capacity to ask all the answerable questions upon which every civilization is founded. And I think it's a really, really interesting set of problems, thoughts that she's confronting us with there. This idea of the unanswerable question. Now, driven by the experience of not knowing, to mean and to know are not the same for Arendt. She really wants to make a distinction. You can have lots of meaning without necessarily claiming to know. So driven by the experience of not knowing, these are questions that will not easily find their limits, their researchable project, their discrete discipline, or their scheduled time. They are, in some ways, outrageous questions, and they may well remind us of what psychoanalysis describes as primal fantasies, the child's and the adult's solutions to the enigmas of the origins of selfhood and culture, of sexuality and sexual difference, of life and death. Or Wilhelm Reich's Where Does the Misery Come From has always struck me as one of the most pressing. Does it need to be said that these questions belong to the university? Perhaps it does need to be said in our particular climate. These questions belong not only to the university, but definitely to the university. Caught up in the experience, then, or even the wonder of not knowing, I think it would be something like what Keats describes as negative capability. That's my attempt to get some English literature into the talk. Caught up in the experience, or even the wonder of not knowing, this is a commitment to the role of the question, not or not only the answer, not or not only the proper distance and disinterestedness of contemplation. It should be said that Benjamin is by no means simply invested in the idea of practice of contemplation that, in the generative comparison between canvas and screen, his essay invokes. On the contrary, in this essay, he comes very close to condemning contemplation as a mode of withdrawal from the demands of a secular public life, communion with the artwork taking the place of human community, as it were. In the decline of middle-class society, he writes, contemplation became a school for asocial conduct, for the hidden tendency to withdraw from public affairs. Now, it's at this point, I think, that we can begin to take the measure of the intervention made by a work like 24-Hour Psycho, or to push the point by those artists and thinkers who strive to discover an image, a thought, a method. Here I'm also thinking of Freud, that will help us to see and hear more of what the world is saying and showing. Let's just go back to that image from 24-hour psycho there. Via the technologies so often supposed to undermine it, Gordon is pushing contemplation to its limits. To bring 24-hour psycho into the gallery, to create an object that takes 24 hours to see, is to push towards the limits of that space and its uses of time, to make an exorbitant demand on the human body and its capacity for looking, standing, attending, and to ask, too, what would it mean to see this? The Guggenheim apparently provided beanbags, but they're not always provided. Sometimes you just stand there. So 24-hour psycho is in principle viewable, but it is not often seen. As Gordon quips in interview, a few people have watched it all the way through, but they are no longer with us. Or, as one commentator puts it, every shot seemed to last longer than all the paintings you've seen in your life. In Point Omega, our man has been standing for more than 3 hours looking. He knew he would stay until the museum closed, 2.5 hours from now, then come back in the morning. Standing was part of the art. The standing man participates. A work on the cusp between cinema and photography, cinema and painting, cinema and video, 24-hour psycho is nothing if not a hybrid object. It is interdisciplinary, transmedium, cross-practice, cross-sight. It repeats and displaces one of the icons of public culture. As one critic put it, is there anyone in the world who doesn't know that in Psycho a girl is stabbed in the shower? His hyperbole helps to make the point. 24-hour Psycho iterates and revisions, too, the unanswerable questions to which Psycho itself gives image. The difference between life and death. Now, after the shower scene, this is one of the most famous images from Psycho, the mummified mother. Now, whether that mother is alive or dead is one of the questions that runs through this film. I've taught it several times. It's rare not to have a student who thinks that Gordon really is his mother and his mother is alive somehow in him. That's the power of that discourse, of that film. People forget that Norman killed his mother, that it's a matricide. So I think this is a film about the difference between life and death, the enigmas of sexual difference and sexual desire, the significance, perhaps above all, of the eruption of violence in the world. Not Daniel, not the prophet or the lawyer. It's not them who respond to the death of a woman in Psycho, but the doctor, the psychiatrist, not law, but medicine, attempts to close down that eruption of violence in the film. So what 24-hour Psycho brings into the gallery, I think, finally, is something like what scholars are doing in the university. And for me, that's where it gets really interesting, that this creative practice and critical thought come right together. There is a convergence in both the filial attention to the object and the necessary displacement of that object, its transformation by that very act of attention, its desire, its creativity, its limits. Gordon calls his appropriation of Psycho a form of kidnap. In the space created between the technological and the aesthetic, the university and the gallery, art and theory, the transformative practice of desire and its attentions, voyeurism, boredom, sexuality, sleeplessness, they all come into play. When I screened 24-hour Psycho in an art environment, Gordon recalls, it gave me a halfway house between the university and the bedroom. And wherever you watched it, the great thing was that you didn't know who you were standing next to. Now, that's an intriguing comment, too, that something about this installation is also about knowing who's around you and who's doing what. And Point Omega is all about that. What am I looking at? In the epilogue to Point Omega, it is a woman who gives voice to the question. It's acknowledgement of the fact that slowing down, working hard to look at what is in front of her, does not, in fact, make the object any easier to see or to understand. and nor should it. Art, like theory, is a way into questions, not a way out of them, especially perhaps when the object in question demands a new art of looking at the world. So thank you for your time.